For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. The Chancellor for Higher Education announces his retirement after 12 years on the job. Glenn Johnson says he'll be leaving the office at the end of next year. The move comes after considerable pressure from Governor Stitt to have him replaced. Ryan, what do you think of this decision?
I mean, you know, first, I think we should celebrate the career of Glenn Johnson, Chancellor Johnson. It's not over yet, but let's celebrate. I mean, he was Speaker of the House in the Oklahoma Legislature in his mid-30s. At the time, he was the youngest Speaker of the House of any state legislature in the country. He was recently recognized as the top chancellor of all of the systems of higher education around the nation. Here's somebody who is a quintessential public servant in the state of Oklahoma. And the most people won't ever really realize the benefit of his public service, but his public service reaches far and wide around Oklahoma. And I can just say personally, his mentorship and friendship over the years, especially when I was in the legislature, I'm incredibly grateful for that. You know, the dynamics of him leaving, of course, you know, he's saying that he left of his own accord, and I think that that's right. I think, though, that he recognized that his relationship with the governor was such that if the system of higher education in the state of Oklahoma were going to have a good advocate, that he needed to clear the path for that to happen. And I think that that's going to happen in 2020.
Neva?
Well, I think while the governor had made it clear he thought it was time for a change, a new face, a new quarterback, as he called it, at the helm in higher education, I think what he saw was the pushback. I mean, almost from the moment that he kind of sent that volley across, it was clear from the chairman of the Board of Higher Regents to many other folks. You heard everyone kind of coming forward saying, this guy's doing a good job. You didn't hear any detractors. I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. This was kind of a wide-open opportunity for those folks who wanted to be the critics of higher ed, or in particular the chancellor, to kind of take a shot, and you really didn't see that. And I think even after this all ensued, we saw the governor take a little more conciliatory response, and basically now we have the stage set. The chancellor has been involved for several years in really leading a task force to not only restructure but to modernize the entire higher ed system, something that everyone acknowledges needs to be done. So I think this gives time for that to be in place. Some of the key new hires that they're looking to bring on, it gives an opportunity for all of those parties to be involved within the higher ed system right now, and then begin to have that conversation in a larger way with the legislature and beyond as he looks toward his official retirement sometime later next year.
And the governor doesn't have any say in who becomes next chancellor.
But those nine regents on the higher ed, I think can, you know, one would anticipate that there's going to be, as they roll off in a systematic fashion their terms, that the governor is going to put his handpicked folks on there, as all governors do. I mean, that's part of the process, and one of the things in these key appointments, regents at the various colleges and universities, as well as the higher education regents, those are considered very significant appointments by a governor during his term.
And Neva, you said, you know, no detractors. I think that that's really important, and it speaks volumes about Glenn Johnson. I mean, here's a guy who, he was a Democratic member of the House. He was a Democratic Speaker of the House, Democratic politician, but came to power as chancellor during a time of Republican ascendancy in the state of Oklahoma. And he did that and managed to transcend partisanship in most every fashion. And I think that that's why you saw a lot of pushback. You know, Governor Stitt calling him John Blake, which, you know, those are fighting words in Oklahoma. I mean, next step is to talk about somebody's mama. And, you know, so whenever he said that, you get all that pushback. That's really reflective of a man who has you know, really worked on both sides of the aisle and put higher education above politics.
And I think when you saw the Senate Education Committee chair, a Republican, right, Gary Stanislavski, who said that basically here's someone who not only has adapted to the position, but he promotes higher ed without a partisan bent. So those were very significant words coming from someone at the helm on the Senate side chairing the Education Committee, and someone who is a Republican.
Oklahoma is paying a Michigan law firm to help with negotiations of tribal gaming compacts. Attorney General Mike Hunter announced the company is getting $250,000 for advice and expertise after Governor Stitt spoke on the phone with at least two of its attorneys. Neva, the tribes say the compacts are clear and need no interpretation. So why spend the money here?
Good question. I think the governor is still intent on having having the process move forward, having this negotiation take place. And right now it's been stymied by, you know, neither side really being able to come to the table in good faith. So by infusing more attorneys into the process and these folks who have a reputation and have a background for being able to deal with complex, compact, and gaming negotiations and issues, maybe that will kind of set the stage where it can be a win-win. And that's really where it has to get to. I mean, largely, you have to have a situation where the governor feels like his takeaway is he gets something he's looking for, the tribes get what they're looking for, but it has to be in an environment where there's enough mutual respect and rapport developed that they can actually have negotiations that go somewhere, and the clock is ticking in terms of the timeline. With every with many folks, and certainly the tribal leadership, believing that January 1, 2020, these compacts automatically renew.
Ryan.
Well, and that's it. That is the legal question in a nutshell. Do these compacts automatically renew? And if you look at the statutory language that enables the compacts, if you look at the compacts themselves, that seems to be pretty cut and dry, that they automatically renew, you know, barring a handful of conditions that would have to happen in the state of Oklahoma between now and the end of the year. And those don't seem to really, you know, be on the forefront. And so without those conditions, you know, basically the lack of gaming at any of the horse racing facilities, that, you know, Remington Park would have to basically eliminate gaming, would be a huge step towards the elimination or the negation of the automatic renewal. But you can pay a law firm in any state you want $250,000, and they'll give you an opinion that backs up what you want it to back up, but that doesn't mean it's going to hold any water in court. I think that the automatic renewal thing here is critical to the negotiation process. If the governor would come out and admit, yes, the way that these compacts are written, they're automatically going to renew, and we need to go into the negotiations with good faith, knowing that if we can't reach an agreement, that we're going to stick with the status quo. If he would, I think, come to the table with that admission, the tribes, I think, would in good faith come to the table and talk about, you know, what the compacts might look like in a different way.
And it's not surprising. We're seeing numbers that show that the revenue growth has been into record numbers across the U.S., and certainly in the Oklahoma City and Tulsa regions. There's a reason why I think Governor Stitt feels like Oklahoma is losing a little bit of money here.
Well, whatever the numbers are, the bottom line is everyone has to get to the table and negotiate.
Right.
And that's where it has to get to, and get to quickly. I mean, there are issues beyond just the ones that are kind of the major ones that have been talked about the most, but you talk about a compact and all of the complexities that are involved in that. There are a lot of negotiating points, I'm sure, that maybe not rise to the level of what we're talking about right now in terms of just the overall gaming component. But there are issues there that have to be addressed, and some of those, if they're not addressed now, certainly may crop up when the legislature comes back into session. So I think it behooves everyone to move forward quickly. This is something that's kind of been simmering along all through the year, and it's now we're into the fall season, and the clock, as I say, is going to run out, if they want to use the football analogy, very quickly, and that does not bode well for the people of the state of Oklahoma. I think all parties have to recognize, let's do what needs to be done to get this resolved, because it's good for all Oklahomans.
Yeah, Ryan, you were talking about when this compact was created 15 years ago, this was kind of a risk for the tribes to even
it's
try
a huge
this.
Risk for the tribes. And, you know, so you look at the way that the breakdown in revenue goes to the tribe, and, you know, the governor's office can say, well, they're getting more than other tribes get in other states. The risk that Oklahoma tribes took on to say, we're going to invest in this new type of gaming, we're going to try to build these casinos and these entertainment venues. And then what they did with that money over the next decade plus has been not only to just invest in casinos, but more often than not, investing in healthcare and infrastructure and education. I mean, the investment that tribes make in the state of Oklahoma is tremendous. And the return that every Oklahoman, regardless of whether you're a member of a tribe or not, has received, the benefits that we've received by tribal growth and their investments in our communities, I mean, it's difficult to put a price tag on that. I've seen some numbers that talk about, but it's really just difficult to put a price tag on the benefit that we as all Oklahomans experience.
The Department of Corrections locks down state prisons after gang-related violence, resulting in one death as well as dozens of injured inmates and correctional officers. Ryan, do you think this is just because of overcrowding, or is there something else?
I mean, it's overcrowding. We've got way too many people in prison. Our prisons are understaffed. And even whenever they are staffed, we're talking about, you know, limited programming, limited opportunities for education, for addiction services, for gang intervention. I mean, these are you know, we're really just warehousing people. It's called the Department of Corrections, and in spite of the meritorious work of a lot of men and women over at the Department of Corrections, correctional officers in particular that are on the front lines and providing those services, they are just overworked and understaffed and underfunded. And it's not only dangerous for the inmates, but it's dangerous for the correctional workers. You know, they're these restorative justice experts, and they're quick to remind us that the main drivers of crime and violence are isolation, humiliation, shame, desperation, and fear. I mean, we do that when we put people in prison anyways, but when they commit a crime, they do that anyways. But in these lockdowns, we make it even worse. And so we just end up exacerbating the situation. So we have this criminal justice system that only makes things worse. And so we've looked at a lot of reforms over the last years, but I think that instead of reform, we really need to just entirely rethink the way that we're treating folks.
Neva.
Well, in looking at the instance of last weekend, the fact that we had in five facilities, more than a dozen inmates that were injured. We had one death. We had a number of correctional officers also injured, none life-threatening. But the significance of this, I mean, it was stated that it was gang-related brawls, and, you know, the fact that they happened in a fairly rapid succession all across the state in five different prisons is cause for concern. I mean, it does raise the issue of what's going on from the standpoint of dealing with this. In our prison system, beyond the issues that we talk about on the criminal justice side and all of that, and when you look at the fact that as of the end of July, even though the legislature gave a pay increase that basically brought the correctional officers up to almost $16 an hour pay, we still find that they have about 55% of their positions, their entry-level positions, unfilled. So, I mean, it is a problem when you have decaying old facilities with all of these systemic problems that we've talked about over and over and over again. We have no new director at the helm leading the Department of Corrections, and then we have all of these flare-ups in these facilities across the state that do give real cause for concern. I mean, not only on the part of the correctional officers and those dealing inside those facilities, but the larger picture of what we do from a state perspective in addressing these issues where we are talking about one of the states with the perennially largest percentage of incarcerated men and women in the country.
Yeah, it's regardless of what you pay these people, when you see the headlines of lockdowns and stuff, it doesn't make you, doesn't matter how much they're going to pay, you're not going to want to go get that job.
Absolutely not. And, you know, not only are we seeing, you know, the entry-level correctional workers, correctional officers, you know, not filling those positions, but one of the things we're seeing this week is, you know, news of senior administration shakeup within DOC itself. So we don't have a director. There have been key senior administration officials who have either left or been forced out of the agency. So there's some vacancies in critical areas and, you know, decision making within the department. The real news here, and I think if Joe Albaugh, former Director Albaugh, were here with us, he would agree with me. And, you know, call in, you know, pledge first, but call in and tell me otherwise. But the real news is that this hasn't happened more regularly, you know, that we haven't seen this kind of violence more regularly.
He actually did say that before he left.
I mean, it's surprising.
Right.
It was one of his chief concerns.
Yeah. It's kind of a miracle.
The Pardon and Parole Board is considering steps to possibly accelerate the commutation process. It plans to work with DOC to create a single-stage document of eligible inmates based off the state question 780 retroactive measure passed by lawmakers. Neva, this could impact hundreds of current state prisoners.
It could, and I think that what we're hearing from the head of the Pardon and Parole Board is that they want to have a system that is implemented with urgency, and I think excellence were the two words that were used, and also do it maybe a little ahead of schedule. We'll see. I mean, they're talking about having this first docket ready maybe by October 1st. I think the actual date that they have to comply is a month later in November.
November 1st, the first day, but
I think we have, when we start to look at this breakdown, I mean, how they do these dockets, and they're talking about three dockets and the complexity of all of that, they've got an incredibly tall order in front of them. And when you think about the fact that as the Pardon and Parole Board. These folks are people that just come from, you know, private citizens coming in, giving of their time to something that is a very, very difficult task and takes a lot of hours. And so I think, you know, oftentimes these are the types of individuals across the spectrum in these state boards and commissions that are unheralded. And I think that we need to remember these are folks who have really stepped up and given a great deal of time and attention and understand the seriousness of the roles that they are involved in this particular instance with the Pardon and Parole Board.
I've heard much talk about members of Pardon and Parole Board. Of course, they don't get paid for this. This is a volunteer. They get paid like a per diem, I think, but they spend hours and hours and
it's
hours
kind of
looking over these papers as they get ready for their next meeting.
You know, we should really have a professional Pardon and Parole Board, you know, no disrespect to our volunteers. Frankly, I mean, if the volunteers, you know, let's start paying them. I mean, you know, we really need, you know, that kind of staff over there and, you know, just dedicated folks that are, and there is some staff, but the people that are really making the decisions, they're volunteers, like you said.
So when you look at the caseload increase is up by 71%,
right.
I mean, that's a staggering number. I mean, it's almost difficult to comprehend when you really think about the literally hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of cases that these folks are now really under the gun to try to be able to work through and make decisions on.
And kudos to them. I mean, what they're, you know, if you think about what they're trying to do here, these, you have inmates right now that because of retroactive application of State Question 780 are no longer required to be in prison. And so if the Pardon and Parole Board drags their feet on this, then we have people that are otherwise eligible to be released, you know, sitting in these, what we were talking about earlier, these very dangerous, decrepit, decaying prisons. And so every hour that you spend in one of those places that you don't have to is, you know, just hell. And so the fact that the Pardon and Parole Board is working diligently to make sure that they either get out before the deadline or as soon as that deadline hits, you know, hundreds of folks that are eligible get released. Others are going to have their sentences reduced. You know, some are going to have their sentences modified, but, you know, they have other crimes that they're serving. And really what this speaks to me is that, you know, we went through, you know, 2016 was when State Question 780 passed. And so it's taken from then to now, you know, 3 years almost since the passage of State Question 780 before we're seeing retroactive application. We should have immediate retroactive application for all criminal justice reform measures. All sentencing reforms should have immediate presumptive retroactive application. You know, and then, you know, if there's some reason why it shouldn't be retroactively applied, you know, let a judge or a district attorney, you know, raise that objection. But everybody moving forward, we should just do that. We shouldn't have a 3-year gap in between.
I think when you look at these dockets, I mean, the first docket, there are 800, I think, individuals on there. Second docket, 600. But then the third docket, that's the most complex of all, I think the number jumps to 2,100 or something. I think that as we see these folks, you know, kind of work through this process, I mean, we have to remember, I mean, because sometimes I think from the public standpoint, they think, oh my, I mean, how many thousands upon thousands of people are just going to flood out of the system? And we have to keep it in context of what's happening here and why it's happening, just as you explained, Ryan.
And you also have to worry about the Willie Horton effect, is basically you don't want necessarily somebody to get out and then cause another crime.
But let's remember, since Governor Stitt was elected, there have only, I think the population decrease in DOC is about 1,500 people. So, yeah. I mean, we're not talking that we've opened the doors and they're just flooding out. And I think that is an important distinction and point to be made for the public who always have pause. I mean, that's why we had the mindset in the legislature for decades of, you know, lock them up and throw away the key, because we're not going to be doing anything on our watch to do anything differently.
So. Well, and that 800 number of folks that, you know, may be immediately eligible for release, that number was a lot bigger back in 2016 when State Question 780 passed, because, you know, we've seen a reduction in the number of folks going into prison for simple possession. Some have been revoked for charges that were prior to 2016, but the overall number has gone down. And a lot of those folks, even if they're going in, or if they were in 2016, you know, they may have had a 2 to a 5 to a 6 year sentence. You know, some of that has been earned time, and, you know, so a lot of them, even though they would be charged and convicted of a misdemeanor today, their felony just simply their time that they served, you know, they were out beforehand. So not only are we having hundreds of people that are getting out, there were thousands of people that were once eligible, but just by the virtue of time, they're already out. And speaking of those folks that are already out, we have thousands, maybe tens of thousands of Oklahomans that are going to be eligible to go and have their records reflect a misdemeanor charge and not a felony charge. So even though they're not in prison anymore, they're still going to benefit
that's
from this
jobs,
new
jobs, that's school. There are so many things you cannot do if you've got a felony
housing,
record.
Yeah.
Finally, we received sad news over the weekend in the death of T. Boone Pickens at the age of 91. America's best-known oil tycoon was not shy of calling for diversity in the energy industry, including investments in wind, solar, and natural gas. Ryan, let's start with you. Your thoughts on T. Boone Pickens.
You know, one of the things that I really like about T. Boone Pickens is that he lived a life of reinvention. I mean, this guy reinvented himself so many times. And there's this quote in the New York Times where they're reporting on his death. And he said, "I have always believed that it's important to show a new look periodically." And he said this in 1994, "Predictability can lead to failure." And so here's a guy who would go from, you know, sitting it with Al Gore, you know, testifying before Congress about environmental protections and investing in wind and natural gas, to supporting to attacking John Kerry in the 2004 Democratic presidential campaign, to then later saying that he was working with Senator Kerry. You know, he was kind of he just led this life of reinvention, and I think that's, you know, for a lot of Oklahomans, that's an Oklahoma story. I mean, the boom and bust cycle, and you know, becoming a new person, and the opportunity that exist with that, you know, is just really something that I enjoy about him.
Neva.
Well, no question. I mean, here's someone, as you say, a self-made billionaire, a real a person whose philanthropy will be remembered not only at OSU and across the state of Oklahoma for decades to come, a real legacy. I mean, $652 million to Oklahoma State University. But when you think about it, his philanthropy extended far beyond that. The number that is referred to oftentimes is somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion. So, I mean, here's someone who is a real, I think, will always be a legend in Oklahoma, someone that people will long remember, not only the name, but who he was and what he did. And I think one of the best descriptions that I read about him, as many folks were sending condolences and written expressions on his on the website boonepickens.com, is that a friend in Texas said that he has the courage of a riverboat gambler and the wisdom of King Solomon. And I think that to me that was just such a perfect depiction of who T. Boone Pickens was. And I think that with the celebration on the campus, it will be a special time. He, as I understand it, he'll be laid to rest on the campus. Mm-hmm. And so I think he is someone that everyone should pause, reflect on his life, and thank God for T. Boone Pickens and what he means to the state of Oklahoma.
Yes, speaking of his wisdom, he once said that his IQ was tied to the price of oil.
Well, and his Boonisms, have been called, are certainly something to go back and to read over and over and over again, because there's so many of them. I mean, the one you hear about when you're hunting elephants, don't get distracted chasing rabbits, or the one about if you're on the right side of the issue, just keep driving until you hear glass breaking, and then don't quit. I mean, he was one of those folks that was charming and loved by virtually every person that crossed his path.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.